Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right, ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Five wins on the spin, top of the championship. If an unmentionable alcoholic brand did Saturdays, they would do them a little bit like that for Norwich City. A 3-0 win against Coventry. We're going to dissect it in detail because there's plenty of strands to unpick and probably some that perhaps just merely looking at the scoreline you wouldn't expect. Welcome to this week's Norwich City podcast from the Pinken in association with Future Radio. Connor Southwell joined by Samuel Seaman and Paddy Davitt to dissect a very, well, probably positive afternoon for Norwich City in the whole, Sam. They're top, as I mentioned, if only for 12 hours or so. Sheffield United, of course, hosting Hull on the Sunday. We've just made the walk back up the road from Carrow Road after that. What was kind of your assessment of the afternoon all in all?
Well, firstly, I'm mainly just thinking about how long you've been working up that introduction about the unmentionable alcoholic brand. But no, in all seriousness, a very good afternoon for Norwich City. And, you know, when you win 3-0, you can't really complain, and Norwich fans won't be generally. But I think it was also an afternoon where it was laid bare the weakness of the championship at times, and Coventry really didn't put in any sort of performance that threatened Norwich at any stage, despite the fact that for probably 20-30 minutes in the second half, at the start of it, they were, you know, at odds really. They seemed to have no idea what they were doing. They seemed a little bit lost on the pitch, and yet two good probably 15 minute spells have done for them in the championship. And I think that highlights the growing gap between Premier League and Championship, given obviously how woefully they failed to survive in the top division last season. So it's not good from that point of view. But, you know, as I said, Norwich fans certainly won't be complaining having won 3-0. They're top of the Championship for the first time this season, and that means they're in a really good position to now kick on and achieve what they want to achieve, which is, I'm sure, not only promotion but winning that title for a third consecutive go in the Championship. So, I don't think we learned anything particularly new about Norwich this afternoon, but there were certainly developments that will help them going forwards. Tamer Pukki scoring his first goal of the season. Another good performance from Aaron Ramsey when he'd been questioned for his performance at Birmingham on Tuesday. So, plenty of good things to talk about. But overall, very routine and not perhaps as encouraging as the scoreline would suggest.
No, I would agree. I mean, you said people won't complain. I'm probably going to complain a little bit later on, so we'll come back to that. And also, on the introduction, what makes that more impressive is that I don't drink at all. So the fact I've been able to pluck that reference maybe suggests that said company had a very good advertising campaign.
You spend too much time on Twitter, to be honest, mate.
Quite possibly that. Pat, I feel like we should just get out of the way kind of your associations with Cole. I feel a little bit like I'm asking...
What do you mean? As if that's some sort of a dirty secret, guy?
Well, it's not. But I feel almost like I'm putting a question to a player about his former club in many regards. So, as an afternoon, because I'm sure people will be interested, what was that like for you watching the club that you grew up supporting? I think, you know, obviously you're a Norwich fan now and whatnot, yeah. But the club you grew up supporting against the club that you cover professionally. I mean, it's quite an interesting dynamic. It's obviously not something that I have to experience, Sam neither.
No, I didn't enjoy it, if I'm brutally honest. Of course.
Which goal did you dislike the most?
The first one was pretty bad. The first one was pretty bad in terms of from a commentary perspective. As Mark Robbins said after the game, he was very impressive in his post-match, actually, given that having a quite an horrendous start to the season. But basically said, if one of my players is trying to do step-overs on the edge of his own box and you've got a predator in Teemu Pukki, then it's only going to end one way, and that was badly. And it's a bit sad at the minute. But, I mean, Robbins is a legend there, what he's achieved, you know, to get him from League Two, essentially, with all the sort of backdrop about not having a home and playing away from Coventry for a period of time. So, you know, they had a good season last season, the Championship top 10, and hasn't quite happened for them at the start of this season for on and off pitch reasons. But I think under him they'll be fine in terms of their status in the Championship. But yeah, as Sam alluded to, it wasn't really a contest for large parts. Other than the support, I think the Cov fans probably won that hands down, even if they didn't have a drum. I'm not trying to be incendiary there, but 1800 were there and they sang from start to finish, and that was the main thing for me. It was nice to hear some of the songs I used to sing on the terraces, so that was a bit of a nostalgia vibe. But I came in with no expectations before the game that Cov would get anything, and so in that regard I was proved right. But my good mate actually, Rich, I'll give him a mention because he's an avid follower of the Pink and content on all our platforms. He called it, he said it would be a 3-0 to Norwich when he saw the team news, and he was spot on. So yeah, I think ultimately, turning it back round swiftly to Norwich, very, very impressive how they managed the game. I know Dean Smith alluded to, thought their standards dropped a little bit after half-time, and Tim Krul had to make a big save at a big moment when it was 2-0. But I think overall, you know, the results and the points now tell you they're definitely heading in the right direction. And, you know, we talked about it, Connor, as we left Carr Road, it's levels within levels in the Championship now, and Norwich's squad depth is ridiculous at this level. It'll be interesting to see how they get on against Burnley this coming Friday, because that'll be, for me, probably the benchmark about where Norwich are going this season. Because, with the greatest respect, I don't think we learn too much from beating very bang average Coventry side, and even Birmingham midweek, albeit they made hard work of that. But I think Burnley feels like the first real acid test. But they're doing everything that's asked of them now, and to be top 8 games in, having not picked up a win in the first 3, is testament to Dean Smith and his players.
Yeah, just on the Cov fans, they bought 1,800, which is, I think, probably the biggest following we've seen. Certainly in terms of noise, they were excellent all afternoon, even in spite of their team's performance. I actually went for a run, or if anyone's seen me run, more of a plod around my area this morning, and there's a pub at the end of my road, and it was about 9:30 in the morning, and there was already a coach full of sky blue shirts in there. So that's pretty impressive. I didn't even know the pub opened that early. So whether they made communications that they were attending said pub, I don't know. But it was an interesting afternoon in many respects, and I feel like, and you're probably going to moan at me or call me a killjoy or whatever, but I still didn't necessarily feel, and maybe this is because of, and I made this point in my verdict, maybe it's because of what we've seen in the past, maybe it's the bar that they've set themselves. Still don't necessarily feel, after what is it, 7 games in the Championship, that Norwich are as fluid or as consistent in their performance levels as perhaps they need to be. But then, Sam, given what Paddy said there about the levels within levels in the Championship and just how big the gap is now in terms of from the Premier League and teams that drop out of the Premier League to everyone else in the Championship, does it matter that Norwich maybe aren't as good as perhaps people will expect them to be, looking at the amount of points they've amassed in the last 5 games and obviously their position in the table?
In the short term, it doesn't matter at all. If they get promoted, they'll be happy. But in the long term, I think that's where people are starting to look now, because they've experienced 2 promotions the last time they've seen Norwich in the Championship. I don't think they're necessarily satisfied with just another promotion. I think they want to see the signs of a team that's able to build on that in the Premier League. And the end goal, we all know, Stuart Webber spoke about it on a podcast he went on this week. The only thing they're working towards is Premier League sustainability and survival. So in a way, no, it's not really enough. I suppose if they don't look like a side that could even compete in the Premier League, which at times they haven't this season, I'm not saying that's always been the case, but, you know, rarely have they looked like a team that's going to comfortably survive and sustain themselves in the Premier League long term. And given that's the goal, I think Norwich fans are right to perhaps judge them on that and judge them on that goal. So it is an interesting aspect of the season. It's almost like whatever they do, they can't be successful because everybody's just waiting to be able to assess them next season, really. So it is interesting, but also, you know, football fans are, and having been one, I can say they're a fickle bunch, and sometimes a simple bunch in terms of what they want. They just want to see their team do well, and they want to see their team win. And in that sense, if they're better than the opposition, it doesn't matter if they're not fantastic. Norwich fans are used to seeing teams much worse than this, and they have seen teams much worse than this in fairly recent years. So, no, I think in the short term, they don't have anything to worry about, but you know, obviously, as we've discussed at length, in terms of the Premier League in future, that is something to be wary of.
This debate, Pad, is it a criticism of Norwich or is it a criticism of the Championship as a whole? Because we've had so many conversations and you only have to kind of cast your eye at the Premier League at the moment. And obviously Norwich aren't in it, but the sheer amount of money that's been spent, a record number, Manchester United, I'll use this sort of statistic courtesy of Kieran Maguire, Manchester United spent more on Antony than the entirety of the 24 teams in the Championship spent all summer. I mean, it's incredible, the financial levels, but it feels like that is now, maybe for the first time since the Premier League formed, translating into levels within the English pyramid as well. And what we're beginning to see, because of obviously the Premier League finances and the parachute payments, is that now begin to affect the leagues below that. So in many ways, when we're talking about maybe Norwich not being at the levels we perhaps expect them to be, that's fine, but they still sit top of the league and they've still won their last five. So it doesn't necessarily feel, I'm not trying to be critical of Norwich necessarily, but even in those moments, and they had a real period in the second half where they were nowhere near their best. They were sloppy, they were loose. And yet, it still didn't really feel like Coventry could land a punch on them. So I don't know really if I'm criticising Norwich City or if I'm criticising the Championship or to be honest, football in general. It's quite philosophical for the start.
Yeah. There's a lot of strands to that. I mean, the stat that blew my head a little bit in terms of the Premier League spending in this past winter was the figure spent in the Premier League dwarfed the Bundesliga, Serie A, and I think Ligue 1, if I'm not mistaken. But three, take Spain out of the equation, but three of the major leagues combined, their spending power was less than the Premier League. So, and you've graphically illustrated that in terms of the Antony deal, vis-a-vis the Championship. It does feel an accelerant has happened, despite, you know, coming off the back of the pandemic and reductions in revenues, seemingly. That all that pent-up maybe demand has spewed over the last few summer months, and you now have almost more disparity, it feels like, you know, because that level of spending is just off the Richter. I mean, whether it comes to pass that Norwich have a wealthy US investment coming in the mid to longer term, even then, struggle to see how they could compete with what's gone on in the Premier League, pretty much top to bottom. You look at Forest. I mean, look at the Forest outlay. I mean, that's absolutely ridiculous. You know, both in terms of scale of players turnover, but also the £100 million plus that they spent, and that's just to give them a fighting chance of staying in the league. So that inevitably will reflect and impact further down the pyramid. Robbins again post match said he felt this summer, for the first time in a couple of seasons, that clubs in the Championship, certain clubs, had spent significant amounts. And I thought you made a very salient point off the back of that. It also might be compounded by the vast majority of the Championship, and Steve Morrison alluded to this at the start of the summer, don't have the funds for whatever reason to spend, and are having to beg, borrow and steal effectively. So if you've got a Norwich, you would expect, are in that small band of clubs who have spent money in the Championship this summer, but the vast majority don't, then the sort of disparity that was already there is only more graphically illustrated. It's a bit too early to make hard and fast conclusions because we're only 8-9 games in, but if we get to the turn of the year and it's Norwich and it's Burnley and it's Watford fighting it out, which is plausible, more likely rather than unlikely, then you have to probably say that does underline again that, you know, the finances, there is an imbalance. And again, Weber on that podcast recently was asked about the parachute payment backdrop that clubs who come down, you know, are afforded. And he was very, as you might say, maybe he's got a vested interest coming at it from a Norwich perspective. But he felt it's a reward for success, not failure. You know, that those clubs, and he was right, when Norwich first went up under Farker, they didn't have any parachute money. When he was at Huddersfield, likewise. Forest last season, albeit they have a wealthy owner. So It's a really complex debate, and I don't think there are hard and fast conclusions you can draw this early in the season. But it feels, on the evidence of the games we've seen involving Norwich, that there is a gulf. And again, that graphically was illustrated today with Dean Smith turns to his bench, on you go, Kieran Dowell, you know, on you go, all those other players on El Hernandez, Gabby, Zara. And these teams just don't have that enviable resources to call upon. So what isn't in dispute is I think Norwich's squad is the best in the division in terms of quality and depth, and that is because they've had the finances to be able to do that. So I think you have to be honest and say that Norwich are riding the wave, which is probably the adverse effect when they're in the Premier League, that they can't really compete on a financial level playing field. At this level, it feels like they have all the financial advantages going. But you still have to buy the right players. You have to have a coach who incorporates them into the right systems, and you know, it isn't a guarantee of promotion, but it certainly enhances Norwich's chances of going back again this season, I think.
Yeah, I find it really interesting when we have this debate, and the external view, people who follow Premier League clubs are so quick to talk about parachute payments rather than perhaps the transfer fees and the outlays that are being made. That's interesting in terms of the way this conversation is being framed within football more widely. I just fear where we're going to end up. And that's not just off the base of that. As you say, that's a longer, deeper philosophical question that we won't have on this podcast. But it's an interesting backdrop to what Norwich City are doing in the Championship at the moment. And Sam, where I would be critical of Norwich is kind of what we spoke about from the outset, really. Dean Smith has said from the start of this campaign, particularly at the moment, he's not that interested in league tables. It's about consistent quality performances. Norwich are winning games, but do you feel that threshold is being met in terms of consistent quality performances? And if so, I think what we've seen from football is that if your performances aren't there, but you're getting results, often at some stage, the two tend to even itself up. So with obviously Burnley on the horizon, I guess the fear is that Norwich's level of performance stays as it has been, but maybe the result isn't different to that.
Well, I think the good thing is that they were better today, I thought, than they were in both of their away games. Obviously, sort of this week. So, you know, they're heading in the right direction, and maybe they are trending upwards just as they get to one of their bigger games of the season in a trip to Burnley. So, you know, in one sense, I don't think they were particularly poor today. But, you know, any discussion about consistency was out of the window if you watched that game today. There certainly wasn't any of that. Even within the 90 minutes, they looked like different teams at times. But then again, if a team is consistently good, they're probably in the Premier League. And I think that's actually when you get towards the top levels, you notice that quite a lot, is that pretty much any professional footballer has to be supremely talented just to get paid to do that job. It's about the consistencies, and it's about delivering on that talent on a regular basis. That's what makes the best players, and that's what makes teams that are successful on a regular basis. So maybe in the Championship, wishing for any kind of sort of perfect consistency is a bit ridiculous, really, because otherwise they wouldn't have been relegated. They would be in the Premier League, and you know, they pulled off some decent wins last year. They beat Watford 3-0, an impressive performance. They beat Southampton 2-1, who are a very stable Premier League side. A few years ago, they beat Manchester City 3-2, and if they were performing like that consistently, they'd still be in the Premier League. So I think consistency is perhaps a more underrated aspect in football, and something which I know Dean Smith wants, but I don't know if he's going to achieve it particularly easily with a side that's not funded by the sorts of ridiculous amounts of money you were just speaking about, really. So in a way, no, they're not meeting Dean Smith's demands, but I think his bar probably won't be particularly high compared to maybe what we see with the likes of Manchester City, Liverpool, who find a way to perform well every week, even if they're playing twice a week. I think what Smith will be looking for, although performances are important to him, is just that ability to find results. And not only did they do that in a basic way in the two away games, they did it with still a pretty decent performance and some really good signs today. So, you know, as far as reaching that level, I don't think they're too far off reaching their own level in terms of consistency. And I think they will probably get there soon. We're seeing some good signs, and they have too many good players to not be doing that, because as we've seen with the substitutions, if a player isn't doing well, there's, you know, you look at attacking midfield, there's probably three options that are good enough to be leading Championship players for various clubs in that league. So, you know, I think they'll find that consistency by virtue of the squad depth, and they've got too many good players to not have 11 that are in form. So I think eventually they will get there, and they will be able to do that, if not week in, week out, then on a fairly regular basis. But, you know, it's not as easy as it sounds just to be producing the good performances on a weekly basis.
Yeah, and I guess to flip that point, on its head, really, and maybe provide some balance. The fact that they haven't had a consistent 90-minute performance, the fact that they are winning games and they have won five on the spin and they're winning these games beyond maybe the two away games that they had, certainly the three home games, I think have been relatively comfortable. The fact they're doing that shows probably the levels that this team can reach this season if it continues on the trajectory that it's on at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, it's all relative. Consistency of performance is there for me at home because they have been in command for those three home wins. I think it's a bit unrealistic if we want to measure that, or the metric is from minute one to minute 90, they don't come off their levels. I think we've touched on it there, bar probably bar Liverpool and Man City, that doesn't apply to any other team in the Premier League. They all, you know, dip within games from game to game.
Sorry to interrupt, but this is kind of my point. So are we measuring them against Premier League performances? Are we measuring them Championship performances? That's the interesting bit for me. And I guess that's kind of where they are, isn't it? Because they are realistically somewhere between the two.
Well, Norwich is two. Let's just use as a benchmark. Norwich is two times have been in this division previously. They've won it both times. Were they consistent from August, September through to the following May, week in, week out? No. They had to grind out results. You know, 17 single goal victories the last time. Many of those, they didn't hit their stride, but they found ways to win. So for me, Smith's an arch pragmatist. I don't think he's looking for some perfection in performance level week in, week out, or from half to half within games. I think he will be very happy if they roll on in the manner they are, if it brings the results that get them back in the Premier League. And as he said, people were quick to throw at him immediately after relegation. It might have even been the day at Aston Villa where it was confirmed, and at post-match press conference there, about, yeah, but what if, almost skipping over this step, and you're already back in the Premier League, and then what next? How do you break the cycle? And he pretty much said, handbrake on. You know, I'm not even bothered about thinking about the what next. My job now is to get this group, or this football club, back to the Premier League. And I think that's the be-all and end-all. I don't think he's future-proofing what he's trying to do in terms of a style of play, how they go about it. That might evolve as we get, you know, past Christmas and things look hopefully rosy in terms of the end goal. But the here and now, he said it after Birmingham. He said to his players, these are the hard yards. Nobody in May, if they've achieved promotion, are going to look back and think, oh, they were under the cosh at Sunderland, they didn't play particularly well, and Birmingham really put it up to them. They'll think, we took 6 points from those two games. And I think that's very much his mindset. But within that, and he has also said this, if you do get consistency in performances, then as a more often than not, results do follow. So the two, one follows the other, I guess, but as a coach. But, you know, for me, there is a consistency in how they're picking up results and also how they're playing at home. So, you know, I'm certainly not, I wouldn't be concerned if I was a Norwich fan that, you know, it isn't the Farker 1.0 kind of way they swept to that title with this flowing champagne-style football. And you score three, we'll score four. But even that, I'm sure if we went back and looked at that in a bit more forensic detail, there was plenty of hard games that first time round under Farker. But there was also a lot of superb football, and maybe that colours a lot of how we view this debate, that, you know, we have seen a Norwich team play with panache and style and just overwhelmed through the quality of their football at this level. But I don't think that's Dean Smith, and I don't think that's this group of Norwich players. If they have to tough it out between now and May to get the job done, I think you're more likely to see that. So I certainly wouldn't be expecting some great leap forward and then suddenly it's Farker 2.0 or 3.0, whatever. I don't think that's likely or realistic this season. It is going to be very much what we've seen to this point, I think, will continue, ideally with a bit more control in terms of the facets of the game that Dean Smith's looking for. But fundamentally, what we're discussing here is the Championship. And the Championship, top to bottom, Saturday, Tuesday, is an endurance test rather than a beauty contest. And I think if Norwich, come the end of the season, are back in the Premier League, then who really is going to pick them up on the style of football? It's all about results.
Yeah, and I suppose it's nice that we can have this debate with them having just won 3-0 at home and sitting top of the Championship. I think ultimately you get to the core of it, and it does feel like probably more of a criticism of the Championship and the quality within it, but probably more so of
I don't want to say the state it's been allowed to get to, because that feels a bit derogatory, but certainly where it is at the moment probably doesn't feel like where it has been in the past as a division in terms of quality. And there are various reasons for that, which again we probably can't get into in terms of this pod. But Sam, let's look at this game in detail then. 3-0, probably a case of two halves for Norwich City, as we kind of got into already around consistency. First half was pretty good, second half wasn't really, to put it simply. But what Norwich did do very well in the first half, and we've spoken about kind of the sheer amount of players they had, Smith seemed to find a system that got the best out of quite a few of them. You look at Aaron Ramsey, who came in and was very good. Timo Pukki came in, scored his goal. He's off and running now. Josh Sargent on the right again. He was probably really the left side that I was looking at and feeling, well, that's probably a little bit lopsided, but naturally that's because of necessity more than perhaps choice. So it was a positive start to this contest, and ultimately two games by half time, the game was pretty much as good as done then, really.
Yeah. I think Smith actually said in his post-match press conference that he felt like they probably should have had more than the two goals they went in at half-time in front. And at that point, I think Coventry provided a little bit of a scare when they had that chance. I think it might have been the first or second minute in that second period that they went 3-1-1. Tim Krul made the good save. But other than that, I don't think there were ever any worries that they weren't going to get the job done, even when Coventry, you know, for the 10 seconds that Carrow Road thought Coventry had equalised, I don't think there was too much fear among the group, you know, or among the watching fans that Norwich weren't going to get the job done. For the reasons we spoke about, Coventry's lacklustre performance, some of the squad depth and individual brilliance that Norwich can call on at Championship level, they were just better. And over 90 minutes, it's hard for such a large gap in quality not to tell and not to be evident in the result. So, yeah, I don't think Norwich really ever had anything particularly to worry about, that system you spoke about and getting the best out of players. I think that's, to be fair, you have to give Smith credit for that. You look at managers like Gareth Southgate and what he's done with England. You know, I don't think anybody's praising Gareth Southgate for being a particularly revolutionary or ingenious coach. The fact is, England had a very good and talented group of players, and he's not got in their way. And I think it's a similar case with Dean Smith in the Championship. Norwich have such a good squad that if the coach doesn't overcomplicate things and doesn't do anything to actually make it worse, and just sends them out as the group of players they are, decently coached, know what they're doing, then I think they're fine. And that's what he did today. Really, he just put probably their 11. Or close to their 11 best players, most in form and available players in the side that he could, and they went out and they were the better team and they won. So you have to give him credit for that. But no, I don't think Norwich were ever really threatened, that they didn't look like they would win. There have been games where it certainly felt like that at Sunderland after 75 minutes. I certainly wasn't of the opinion that Norwich were going to win that game. Birmingham going 1-0 ahead, you thought maybe it's one of those nights. But honestly, Coventry probably could have taken the lead after the dominant spell Norwich had early on. And I probably still would have thought that Norwich were going to come back and win that. So, yeah, that golfing quality, when it's that big, and, you know, I'm not saying Coventry have a squad that isn't going to be able to compete at Championship level at times this season, but just today they were poor. Norwich have the players where that maybe they were average, but that's certainly good enough to create a massive gap, and that was always going to tell in the score, in my opinion.
Yeah, Aaron Ramsey, Pad, it was his first start at Carrow Road. We saw him start on Tuesday night, and it wasn't, I mean, he was okay. I didn't think he was particularly brilliant or particularly terrible. He was fine. He got through it and was okay. Obviously, last weekend he set up the goal for Josh Sargent to score. It was the first time we've seen him in kind of a 10 position, and there's been a lot of people who have maybe been slightly underwhelmed by his start and probably by his profile as well, let's be honest. He's someone who's come on loan from Aston Villa, Dean Smith's former club. That creates a certain type of narrative, I think, and probably a certain type of pressure on him as well. But also his CV, the fact he spent the second half of last season on loan at Cheltenham and having registered one assist or scored one goal, didn't you know, set the world alight. He's come into a side hoping to be at the top end of the Championship. And I think there's been some kind of conversations around that and whether that was the level of where he is at this moment in time. I think any questions around that were probably put to bed by half time in this game, because he was really excellent. He added a real injection of creativity and also plenty of ideas in the attacking third, which hasn't always been the case in Norwich City performances in recent weeks.
No, I mean, as Dean Smith said, he brings vision and awareness and quality on the ball, and all those strands were illustrated by the role he played, key role in Josh Sargent's goal. You know, people will either have been there live or they may catch up with the highlights, but, you know, just to kill Timo Pukki's cutback and then immediately shovel it on, you know, almost as if he had a sixth sense that Josh Sargent was going to be there in the middle of the box. It was a Premier League-esque piece of play, I thought, and he is a Premier League player. He's a very young man, but he's highly, highly regarded. You know, he's among his peer group in England, amongst the best players at his age currently, and that is raw talent that Smith, Shakespeare and Bramley, Liam Bramley, first team coach, who helped him, was part of the coaching team that won an FA Youth Cup with him. So you're talking about an exciting prospect, but he's raw and he's inexperienced, and he's obviously having to come into a new group in a new league, and maybe that explains some of the underwhelming early performances and cameos. Dean Smith hit the nail on the head. You touched on he got a start at Birmingham off the back of he was excellent at Sunderland in when he came on, capped by the assist. Through that, he got a start at Birmingham, but Dean Smith said he did okay, but it was kind of an okay that, you know, would have wanted more, and I'm sure the lad himself would have wanted to produce more at St Andrews. But gave him another opportunity today in a slightly different position, and boy, did he respond. You know, deserved his standing ovation from many parts of the ground when he came off in the 70th minute, give or take. And really, really exciting to see how he goes now in that central role, because I don't think we necessarily felt he would be entrusted with the responsibility in a key area of the pitch, but the way he was linking up with Cantwell and Nunes and Sargent bodes well. And you just think, with the caveat, of course, when he's so young, is that, and we're talking again, it feels like this pod is completely talked about consistency, but in terms of young players, you do tend to find those dips and they'll go up and then they'll go down. So probably best not to run away with the idea now that there is the answer to, you know, a key position creatively in the final third. But on his day, he looks to have the quality to really leave a lasting impression. And it's just about how Smith manages him and how he develops now on this path. But good signs, I think. Because, yeah, you're right, there was probably pre-Sunderland a few questioning quite what was he and what is he and what had Smith seen in him, because he was talking up his abilities as a very intelligent footballer. I mean, that was pretty much the first thing he said once he'd arrived. I don't think we've seen too much evidence of that. But this last, well, certainly Sunderland and today, you can see what he's talking about. That there is a player who adds a little bit different to what is currently in that Norwich mix, which, as we talk about, there is a lot of good players, but maybe nobody quite bringing what he brings to the party. So, yeah, positive signs. And you just hope he'll be full of confidence now, I'm sure, after that performance. And he just carries on in that vein at Burnley on Friday.
Yeah, good stuff from him. Good to see us as well. Sam, Timo Pukki back in the team. It feels like there's some kind of natural order resumed. Seeing Timo Pukki's name back on the score sheet, it was a Timo Pukki-esque goal, really, wasn't it? Excellent finish. Marcelino Nunez wins the ball high up the pitch, threads him in. Lovely pass. For me, it's not really the first touch or the finish. He takes a touch to kind of shift the ball onto his left foot, which he almost takes the ball away from McFadden and basically says, well, if you're going to tackle me, you're going to foul me and it's going to be a penalty. It's a really intelligent touch. It's almost half a second in terms of the time he takes. Really cultured, experienced finish. But his all-round game, I mean, he's kind of done it in the last two away games, came on and provided a real impetus. I mean, if anyone needed any reminder, not that they should in these circles, that Timo Pukki is a quality operator, then that performance topped off with a goal today probably proved it again.
Yeah, I think he was gearing up to it. There were some, to be honest, pretty poor performances at the start of the season where he looked not only disinterested but maybe a little bit tired, and he wasn't very effective in a team that, you know, it feels like a long time ago now, but you remember back to Cardiff, they didn't look like they were going to create a chance all season. You know, and I think he's now come back into the team and looks like a different player. I wonder, given the impact we've seen it have on the likes of Tim Krul before, with Ralph Fearman a few years ago, and now with Angus Gunn, I think he's been much better. I think it could be a similar situation with Pukki and actually having some genuine, serious competition. Yes, he's had Jordan Rhodes and Jordan Hugill, who, you know, have been able deputies, but he's never actually been threatened for his starting place, which was absolutely what was happening with Josh Sargent. He had to step out for injury for, I think, 2 games. And then he's come back and he was fit and on the bench. And that was an extreme rarity for his time at Norwich City. So I do wonder if that's perhaps given him a little bit of a kick somewhere where he needed one, and improved his performances a little bit. But what was even more encouraging to see for me was the fact that they both scored today, and the fact that Pukki has impressed up front with Sargent on the right against Sunderland as well. That was where Sargent found that winning goal from, shows that they can both perform. And I was a little bit worried that, you know, Smith would try and appease maybe fans or one of his most experienced and high-profile players in Pukki by sort of crowbarring them both into the team, and that it would nullify the threat of one of them, namely Sargent, given he's obviously going to be the one stuck out on the right. But the fact that he can perform in that role and he can still score goals and ease that burden on Pukki to find the net, I think is majorly encouraging, and we've now seen that on 2 occasions. So I think that was very good to see, the fact that Pukki scored that goal. I think of all the types of goal he could have scored, the fact that he scored an absolute trademark Tamer Pukki goal was really good to see. And I think there were certainly flashes of a certain partnership we've seen before in a South American attacking midfielder showing a little bit of bite and stealing the ball off an opposition midfield player and then playing a very well-weighted through ball first time. Pukki then just tucks it away. And I think once he got into that position, once he took that very, very intelligent and good touch that you referenced, I think that everybody in the stadium that's seen Tamer Pukki play before and seen a few of his goals before knew that that was ending up in the back of the net. So, yeah, it's fantastic to see him sort of back on top form. And if he can stay like that and if he can continue to perform, which I'd suggest he could now that he's got the likes of Nunez and Ramsey, probably is capable of playing those sorts of balls through and providing him with the sorts of chances he likes to feed on. Looks like he's in a good position now to get back to exactly where he was. Well, I was going to say 2 years ago, but he's continued it, unlike the rest of his teammates in the Premier League before. But it looks like he's going to be back to where he was, a happy, healthy Norwich City striker. And that's only good news for those of a yellow and green persuasion.
Yeah, Marcelino Nunez, no consistency, just vibes, but I think I'm okay with that, to be honest. Tamer Pukki now scored more goals for Norwich City than Grant Holt, which is staggering, really. 21 to go, really, for this season, isn't it? To get to 100, which would be quite the achievement. That would put him among the very best Norwich City goal scorers in their history, and in my view, very, very achievable with how many games have we got left? I'm not very good at maths. 39?
Yeah.
Round there. Already at the stage where we lost count of how many games are left. That's the championship for you. I was going to ask you, Pat, about Josh Sargent, because he had to play in a slightly different role, but I thought Dean Smith made a good point in his post-match press conference, which is because teams, a lot of teams at this level play three at the back, Kov did so again, it pretty much allowed him to play as a second striker. So even though he was a right winger, it did feel like almost Norwich had a front two at times, and they did get a lot of joy out of combinations between Sargent and Pukki. So I think if you were looking at it, asking the question, can they play in the same team? I think on the evidence of what we saw today, that's probably an emphatic yes.
Against, as you say, that type of defensive setup, I'd still like to see him against the back four, how it quite works. But yeah, Dean Smith did make the point that he occupies another one of those centre-backs and allows him to operate a bit more down the middle, and then obviously you get the width from, as it was, Max Aarons, or, you know, Ramsey pulling out there, or, you know, on occasion Nunez and Cantwell interchanging. So yeah, it just feels that, and goes back to what we said earlier, that I think there's not too many championship teams who would be able to nullify a Pukki and a Sargent with the right supply lines around them, and as a result, you know, 5-5 for that man now. He's well on his way now to be in the conversation for, you know, if he stays clear of injury and illness and suspension, then it looks like he could be in the conversation for top goal scorer. And you know, if he's got Pukki pushing him and it's an internal battle that's sparking Norwich, then all the better. That's what Dean Smith wants. But I think it does feel like it's been put to bed, this debate that it you can't have both, that somehow, you know, that will nullify a lot of what Norwich are trying to do, to the detriment of the shape and the structure, because in the last two games, both of his goals have come in the centre of the box. So, you know, it's about intelligence and awareness and knowing where the space is and attacking it. And you know, Pukki's a very intelligent player. Smith referenced that again after the game. You know, he makes runs a lot of people don't see. It's just high-class movement, and that's the hallmark of his game. So I think he's more than intelligent enough to work of a fashion that gets the best out of both of those players, rather than, you know, one almost dominates the other. So, and it needs to happen, because as good as it felt today watching Timu Pukki, he is, you know, 32 going on 33 this season, and he does need, as Dean Smith said, the minute he's walked through the door back in November 2021, easing the burden on that man, goal-scoring wise, is one of his priorities. And small sample though it is, he looks like he may have found an answer in Josh Sargent. And, you know, that needs to continue, because, you know, I don't think Timu Pukki over the entirety is probably going to weigh in quite the numbers he has done previously, because, you know, his powers are starting to dim, I think, but not to the extent where they're eroding that he won't threaten, you know, 100, as you say, for the club if he gets another 21. But I think it's unrealistic to expect him to shoulder the entire burden now, and nor should he, not in this squad with the attacking armoury that they've got. No Adam Eder even, you know, this afternoon. And, you know, ultimately, it's an interesting dynamic that's building, but Josh Sargent is, well, you can't drop him at the minute. That's a testament to that man.
I thought you were going to say on fire there, which would have been apt. Some other stuff around the game. There was a drum, Sam, which was interesting. Now, I'm not going to criticise his drumming abilities, because I can't play a musical instrument, so I don't feel like that would be necessarily particularly fair. But it did feel, well, I'm not really sure he could see the game a lot of the time, because he was positioned, for anyone that hasn't seen, not in the stand, but basically on a piece of scaffolding, sort of underneath the big scoreboard. So between the away fans and the home fans, it also seemed to me like he needed a bigger drum, but also that, and again, I don't want to be, it's not my place to be overly critical, but that he also probably had one tune a lot of the time. But I mean, it's the first time we've seen it. There's been a clamour for it, given kind of the impact that it's had amongst away atmospheres. What did you make of it?
Yeah, I think needing a bigger drum is probably a good and astute assumption. I don't know if we're going to see.
They might as well go full hog, big bass. That's
yeah, it wasn't particularly loud, was it? I mean, we are about halfway round the ground from where he was, so I suppose in the Barclay it might have sounded very loud, and I'm sure they'll be wary of perhaps ruining that match day experience for those that just want to go and enjoy the game. Although, you know, without wishing to stereotype, I can't imagine those in that corner are particularly bothered about noise. But yeah, maybe we'll see some sort of announcement from the club in the next few days, official band consultancy from the Salvation Army or something, and we'll see a bigger drum come in. But no, I think it's good to see that they're making strides to be a little bit more accepting of maybe alternative methods to try and, should we say, drum up an atmosphere at Carrow Road. You know, we saw the flags today as well, so generally I think these sorts of initiatives are good. I've spoken before about how watching a game live is a different thing to watching it on the TV, and there's a reason why you want to be there, and it's because fans want to contribute. They want to get behind the team, and they don't only want to watch it in a sterile environment. They're going for the atmosphere and to be around the noises and the sights as much as they are to actually watch the football and see what's going on there. So I think cultivating a better atmosphere is probably important. Without criticising too much, I don't think Carrow Road is included in too many top 10 lists for the best atmospheres in English stadiums. I think when things are going well, there's certainly a lot of goodwill, and I think in recent home games, the Barclay especially, have been getting behind the team really well. But anything that helps that atmosphere, which is something, you know, I think fan groups have been trying to work on for a really long time now, is really good. And to see some of that red tape finally removed, I know people have been pushing for the drum and other initiatives for a long time now, but to see that red tape removed, I think, is good news for probably a large amount of supporters. And I understand there's probably a lot of people that will feel their Carrow Road experience is diminished by these sorts of initiatives, but I would say, based on the majority, it probably is a good thing.
Yes, indeed. Forget the drill. I'm just sending on El Hernandez to warm up every 5 minutes and we'll get the atmosphere going. Pads, quickly, drum, thoughts?
I have no thoughts, Connor. Here in a professional capacity, if people want to hit a drum, it's entirely up to them. But there you go. I've made my point clear earlier on. I think the Cov fans probably won the vocal gymnastics hands down, but then it's probably easier when you're in a confined away space. Norwich's away support is very vocal, so. But you know, deadline day signing for the drum. Let's go give it a chance. Let's not be too hasty to consign it, or look for an upgrade on the drum. I'm sure he'll go home and reflect on his drumming, and he'll come back stronger for the experience.
Indeed. Indeed. I think it was Chris Lakey, obviously our head of sport here. He tweeted after the game that I tweeted that there was a drum, and that was an interesting fact. And he said that the only place a drum belongs is behind a lead singer. So I think that's maybe a point in case about that. Let's turn back to the football then. We kind of touched upon this. So next Friday, Pad, Burnley, a team that Norwich City were relegated with. Burnley actually finished with significantly more points than Norwich City did last season. They've obviously had probably a bit more upheaval with the removal of Sean Dyche as manager. That came after Norwich City beat them at Carrow Road in May, one of the few Premier League wins. Vincent Kompany is obviously there now, so we have to call them Vincent Kompany's Burnley. That's written into law. As a test and as a challenge, this feels probably like the biggest one they've had. I mean, I kind of said before I was a little bit disappointed around the whole Alex Neil saga with Sunderland, because that felt like quite an interesting game for them to have given the start that Sunderland had. But it just got, to be honest, sort of overthrown because of the antics and everything that happened in the 24 hours before that. But Burnley feel like they are going to be in that sort of top cohort of clubs come the end of the season. This is a real test against a side who do like to play football and do have kind of a real clear style of play.
Absolutely, yeah. With the greatest respect to the previous eight opponents, this is the type of game that I think will give us a real indication of where Norwich can go potentially. And the Dean Smith, not definitive in any way, shape, or form, given how early it is. But just looking at it here now, you know, they think if they hadn't conceded a 98th minute equaliser to West Brom on Friday, they're on a point less than Norwich from eight games. Turf Moor, they've won one and drew three, so that's the challenge facing Norwich. Can they go there and be the first team to get a win at Turf Moor in the league this season? Really interested to see how that plays out and the company, that whole sort of project. It does feel like a departure. Massive name in the game. I'm sure his name alone has attracted a few players to go to Burnley and want to be part of that. So for me, it's kind of, I feel that they will get there at Burnley, bringing him in. It's just how quickly they go on that journey, and is it this maybe too early this season? Will it need a transitional period? But early results would tell you he's already, you know, getting his ideas across. So put it this way, if Norwich get back on the coach Friday night and they've got a win, then whether they've, you know, merited it or not, if they've got another win on the board, six on the spin, and they've, as I say, been the first team to go there in the Championship this season and get 3 points, then I think it really tells us what's in store for this group this season. But conversely, you know, my mind goes back to the previous title win at this level, and they went to Watford, another team in the same bracket, another relegated team previously. That was Boxing Day, I think, and they fell the wrong side of it. And they got beat 1-0, I think, that day, didn't they? And Ismail Assar was very good, but that didn't prove too terminal in the final analysis, and there's far more games to go after this coming game than there was then. So We won't draw any too definitive conclusions, but it just feels if Norwich were to go there and get the result, that really does send out a clear signal, because I think we all expect Burnley and the Watfords of this world to be, and Sheffield United now, clearly the start they've had, to be in that front rank competing for the top two. So any time you can land a blow on a direct rival, it's a good day at the office.
Yeah, it kind of lends into the conversation we were having earlier about maybe how we've seen it at the Premier League, really, how they're
we're almost getting mini leagues within leagues, and it certainly feels like we're probably going to end up with something similar in the Championship this year. You'd certainly put Burnley in a similar place to where you would put Norwich, I think, towards the top end, and actually I think the top four at the moment is made up of teams who have been in the Premier League in the last 2 years. Again, just to add that to the debate that we had earlier, but Sam, if Norwich can, as Paddy says, record a win and do it however they do it, at Turf Moor in the Championship, that would essentially make it three wins from Sunderland, Birmingham, Burnley. I mean, that's your Championship bread and butter, isn't it? If you're a side hoping to get promoted, if you can take maximum points at Turf Moor this year, probably very few teams will do it. But if you can do that, it's probably a marker of a good side, and also that you're probably on the way to doing something pretty special.
Yeah, on the flip side, I wonder if they would take a draw, to be honest. They've won five games, and if you look at the 2018-19 Norwich City side especially, but also the last time they went up, I think they their bread and butter was winning against the team they're expected to win against. And if you can do that without giving too many free points to your sort of top six rivals and taking draws here or there, then you can afford to maybe not put in incredible performances, because, you know, by Championship standards, it's going to be a huge leap from what they faced at home against Coventry to what they're going to face away at a very tough ground against a very good team in Burnley. So I think it's maybe more, and if Dean Smith is going to talk about consistency as an important point, then probably coming out of these games relatively unscathed is and making sure you do the job when you're supposed to do the job is probably more of a realistic target than thinking, you know, are we going to go to Turf Moor and win 3-0 and send out a statement to the rest of the league. I just think that's not maybe the best way of going about things in a particularly gung-ho fashion rarely pays off in the Championship, where you're against well-organised teams who maybe don't have the same talents or consistency as Premier League teams, but they can certainly make you pay if you go in there, you know, overly gung-ho. So I think Dean Smith, being the pragmatist that he is, maybe would take a point at Turf Moor, but as it's perhaps more valuable as a measuring stick, as you said, really it's more of a signal to opposition teams and probably to Norwich's own fans. It's an important fixture as well to show them exactly where this Norwich team are, because with the teams they've beaten, they could well just have proven that they're sort of in and around playoff standard. They haven't necessarily proven that they're going to be fighting for those automatic places yet. The fixtures recently have been fairly kind, barring that Sunderland fixture. I think they were against teams who Norwich were going in against as overwhelming favourites. So, I think it's going to be a very good measuring stick, but I don't think going in there thinking Norwich have to win is probably the best mentality for them to have.
Indeed. Just to conclude the pod then, deadline day was Thursday. Instead of the window kind of slamming shut at Norwich, it was, I think, gently pushed, and then someone put the chain on at about 2 minutes to go. It was a pretty uneventful day. I think Flynn Clark returned from Walsall. That was about as exciting as it got. But crucially, Norwich didn't get the left back they wanted, Pad, despite Dean Smith saying at his pretty much press conference ahead of this game that they were quite far down the line with one, and it obviously didn't materialise in the way they would have hoped. It's now a case of just, I don't know, getting Sam Byram in the Cryo Chamber, is that what it's called?
Yeah,
Cryo Chamber, and trying to muddle their way through until obviously the three come back.
And this afternoon was, I think, evident of the approach that, you know, he went for about 70 minutes and then he got him off and Kenny McLean switched back there, because I said to you during the game that given his history of injury and given he's not had a pre-season to speak of, really, that it's that final quarter when fatigue kicks in and the muscular injuries are going to be high risk. So, you know, again, Smith fully aware of that situation and got him off when the game was done, in his opinion. So, puts a lot of onus on him. Also puts a lot of onus on Max on the opposite flank, you know, who heaven forbid if he got injured, then, you know, they are scraping the proverbial barrel in terms of the gap between now and Yiannoulis and McCallum and Sorensen, to a lesser point, being available, which probably isn't going to be until either side of the World Cup, which is, you know, a considerable block of games between now and then. They've rolled the dice and you hope that you know, they get the right outcome. But Lord knows Sam Byram deserves an injury-free run, given what he's had to endure in his career in the last two seasons or so. But Yeah, I think there's still going to be that nervousness anytime he goes on the floor or Max on the opposite flank. But they've weighed it up, as Dean Smith said on Friday. You know, they didn't quite get one over the line. So, you know, they've made a calculation on the balance of probabilities, and now we'll see, you know, if they're correct or not. Certainly if, you know, heaven forbid, a Byron or a Max were out for any length of time, I think they could expect some clear scrutiny on this decision not to go in and try and make a left back happen. But you know, I thought it was interesting the way Dean Smith was framing that sort of after the Birmingham midweek game, when it was almost like, well, we just need a stopgap in terms of if you're going approaching potential left backs and you're saying, well, actually, we want you to come, but you know, probably by November you'll be out the side again. So, you know, was that a tough sell? But ultimately, you know, it is where we're at, and I guess as long as McLean stays fit, then they'll feel they've got enough cover in that left back position. But you know, in contrast to, and we've spent a lot of this pod talking about it, the top end of the pitch, midfield, where it's, you know, they could interchange any number of players and still put specialists in those positions. That isn't the case at fullback. That is where the bed sheet is being pulled very thin, and you just hope that they get the rub of the green between now and Yiannoulis / McCallum being available.
Was it Ledley King at Spurs who basically went a few years without having a training session, just used to play matches?
They, Paul McGrath as well,
yeah. That's what they need to do with Sam Byram, isn't it? Just make sure that he can get through the matches and maybe stick him in that chamber during the week and make sure he's nice and, make sure he's defrosted for the weekends mainly. Pad, Sam, thank you very much for joining me. Thank you very much for listening. Of course, plenty more content across the week on pinken.com, and as well, keep plugging it at the end of the podcast. If you're yet to take your mumps free trial out on Pinken Plus, you can do that at pinken.com, tab on the top left, following all the instructions, and you get all the access to exclusive articles but also videos as well, and a nice ad light experience, which is always a good thing as well. Thank you very much for listening. Enjoy the rest of your weekend and your week, and hopefully by the time Norwich City kick off at Turf Moor next weekend, they're still top of the Championship table. See you soon.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.